Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You could use a shortwave radio with the schedule of English language broadcast, or it's simpler to use a computer or a smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from France 24, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, NHK Japan, and Radio Havana Cuba. We will begin with France 24. First, world leaders briefly responded to the inauguration of Donald Trump. Then some press reviews from Israel and other Middle Eastern countries on the election and remaining military tensions. Then some press on Elon Musk and his controversial salute that was a major topic across the European press. Then a report on the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Agreement on climate, including the removal of environmental protections that Biden had erected in his final days as president. France 24.
As world leaders rushed to congratulate Donald Trump on his inauguration, Panama was a notable exception. In a statement, President José Raúl Mulino slammed the U.S. president's recent threat to take back the Panama Canal and claimed that the canal is and will remain Panama's property. In Europe, several countries, including Germany, said they would continue to work closely with the U.S., but warned they would stand firm against any form of economic pressure.
When it comes to climate, trade and international politics, we obviously have different views. We as Europeans must stand on our own 2 feet and protect our peace and freedom more strongly.
Meanwhile in Israel, a beaming Benjamin Netanyahu congratulated his old friend and ally and expressed hope Trump's second term would help bring about lasting political change in the Middle East.
I'm confident that we will complete the defeat of Iran's terror axis and usher in a new era of peace and prosperity for our region.
We've picked up on a number of articles in the Middle East, Leo.
I'll begin in Israel, of course, one of the United States' great allies. Jerusalem Post leading with Trump's declaration that it was God who saved him. Even more interestingly than that on their front page, is Iran approaching its day of reckoning sometimes this year? Negotiations will be held with the country, but for how long will Trump let them run before demanding concessions from Tehran? And who would attack Iran if negotiations fail? Just Israel or Israel alongside the US? Well, that brings me on to the Tehran Times. They have this rather fiery front page this morning. Traitors setting a war trap for Trump. They accuse Israel of telling the ignorant president, as they refer to Trump, to underestimate and attack Iran. But if they do, they will face heavy consequences, they say. I'll bring you a few more front pages from around the world, starting here in France with Libération. In a speech heralding extreme violence, Trump promised a golden age. The nightmare begins again, they say. Over in Spain, El País called it Trump Unleashed. They focus on the announcement of mass deportations of Mexican migrants as well as the militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border and, of course, Trump's declaration that he'll be changing the name of Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America. Over in the UK, the left-leaning tabloid Daily Star have this headline, "So help us God." They refer to Trump as an orange man baby. I want to finish with this Guardian article reporting on one of Trump's executive orders withdrawing the US from the World Health Organization. Such a withdrawal would, in effect, cut the agency's funding by 1/5. The severe cut would be uncharted territory for the WHO because it would pressure the organization to attract private funding and providing an opening for other countries to influence the organization.
Gosh, and it was one of the first orders that he signed, wasn't it, to take them out of the WHO. However, it wasn't all about Donald Trump, Leo. Some articles picking up on Elon Musk.
Huge controversy around the billionaire Elon Musk. Again, this photo of him saluting at the end of his speech at the Capital One Arena. The Atlantic have this piece this morning. Did he actually do that? So they're asking, did he actually Sieg Heil? Because according to them, it looked very much like a Nazi salute. According to this piece, there's two conclusions. But which one is it? A mask-off full Nazi moment or just a graceless tech baron not in full control of both of his arms and feelings? The author says that Musk hardly deserves the benefit of the doubt given his history and what we know about him. They conclude by saying that what is undeniable is that watching Musk do that on stage while thousands stood on their feet cheering was more than ominous. Across the internet, neo-Nazis are thrilled at what they believe is a direct signal. In many ways, it's a fitting spectacle to begin the second Trump administration, they say. A bunch of people arguing endlessly over something everyone can see with their own eyes. And as we can see in the Washington Post, Musk start to life as a government representative has started rather roughly. Musk is heading the Department of Government Efficiency, but a lawsuit against it was filed within minutes of the inauguration on Monday. The 30-page lawsuit challenges the legality of the Government Advisory Committee. All of their meetings, including those conducted through electronic media, must be open to the public, the lawsuit states. So Musk under huge pressure just a few hours into the new presidency.
Well, let's pick up on a little bit of that now with Antonia Kerrigan, who's with me here in the studio. And Antonia, you're going to talk to us first of all about Donald Trump pulling the United States out of the Paris climate deal. Just explain to us why it is he's decided to do that.
Well, this was part of an executive order entitled Putting America First in International Environment Agreements, language we've obviously heard before. And this, to state the obvious, means that the US is no longer a co-signatory to this objective of keeping global warming under 2 degrees, ideally 1.5 degrees, above pre-industrial levels. And it also revokes and rescinds what's called the US International Climate Finance Plan. That was a Joe Biden initiative intended to make money available for developing countries both to reduce their own emissions and also to adapt to a changing climate. In 2024, that was worth $11 billion during the course of the year. That money is now gone. And when you ask why he's doing it, the strong suggestion he's making is that America globally is carrying an unfair burden. Let's listen to how he justified this.
But I'm immediately withdrawing from the unfair one-sided Paris Climate Accord ripoff. The United States will not sabotage our own industries while China pollutes with impunity. You know,
So let's talk a bit about this China argument. If we look at a graphic here that tells us a little bit about emissions, you can see on the left recent emissions. China is currently polluting much more than the US is. However, historically, cumulatively, these figures on my right show that cumulatively the US has overall put far more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere than China ever has. US emissions did peak back in 2007, roundabout, and Chinese emissions may now have peaked. The jury's still somewhat out about that. But certainly this narrative whereby the US is being asked to foot someone else's bill because they've got deep pockets, it's not entirely accurate, certainly.
And look, Antonia, another big theme of Trump's is protecting US industry as he sees it. He's used that phrase several times, hasn't he? Drill, baby, drill. Tell us about the orders he's done so far that relate to boosting fossil fuel production.
Well, they're many and varied. One of them declared a national energy emergency. Another was entitled Unleashing America's Energy Potential, and wording in those included removing what he called burdensome and ideologically motivated regulations on energy, read oil and gas. Of course, Joe Biden made certain take certain steps to make renewables, to boost renewables production. And also on the list of executive orders, lo and behold, was a temporary withdrawal of all areas on the outer continental shelf from offshore wind leasing. So he's, on the one hand, mitigating renewables, and on the other hand, looking to boost oil and gas production. He also revoked Joe Biden's last-ditch effort about 2 weeks ago, a memorandum aimed at protecting coastal waters from drilling, again on the outer continental shelf. There's also the Unleash Alaska's Extraordinary Resource Potential executive order. So a lot of the word unleash, a lot of this idea that regulation in the Biden years has been preventing America from having access to cheap, reliable energy, and that now it is time to unleash all that through heavy, heavy drilling. Of course, it remains to be seen how much he will increase that kind of potential, but a lot of that is extremely controversial.
Those reports and press reviews were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. Next, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. More on the salute made by Musk at the inauguration festivities. In Germany, a Nazi salute can lead to a 3-year prison term. One of the executive orders Trump made revoked sanctions against Israeli settlers accused of violence in the occupied West Bank. An interview with Fawaz Gerges from the London School of Economics on the change in settler policy. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
A hand gesture by billionaire Elon Musk during a speech at Donald Trump's inauguration is causing controversy, with some comparing it to a fascist salute. Let's take a look at a celebratory rally in Washington while thanking the crowd. There you see it, the world's richest man slapping his right hand to his chest and extending his arm outward in a gesture that resembled a Nazi salute. Musk then turned to the audience behind the podium and repeated the gesture, as we've just seen. So we can take a closer look at all this with the DW's political correspondent, Matthew Moore. Matthew, this is the video that has lit up the internet. So what exactly is happening here? Did Musk do it? Did he not do it?
Well, there's only one person, I think, that really knows whether this was a fascist salute, and that is Elon Musk. But it's fair to say that social media really blew up with clips of this gesture, of this moment going viral, especially here in Germany, Claire, where the gesture is really associated with the Nazi dictator Adolf Hitler and that era, the Nazi era. And the internet was really alive with people debating whether this was indeed a fascist, a Hitler salute. On the one hand, you had historians saying, of course it was, it had the hallmarks of the salute. On the other hand, we saw groups like the Anti-Defamation League, which campaigns against anti-Semitism, coming to Musk's defence and saying, look, this was, quote, an awkward gesture in a moment of enthusiasm, but it wasn't a Hitler salute. And then you had Elon Musk himself thanking them on his X platform and liking or endorsing another tweet which called the criticism tired. And so really, ultimately, no one can know the intent of this moment, of this gesture, what was behind it, apart from Elon Musk. But it's really kind of worth underlining that this salute is hugely, hugely controversial, especially in Germany, where it's a criminal offence to do it. And it's punishable with up to 3 years in prison or a fine.
In another of his executive orders, President Trump has revoked sanctions on Israeli settlers accused of violence in the occupied West Bank. The sanctions were imposed by the Biden administration in response to attacks on Palestinians. Biden had repeatedly urged the Israeli government to hold the extremists to account. The sanctions targeted numerous individuals and settler organizations, freezing their U.S. assets and barring Americans from dealing with them. The Palestinian Authority says Trump's decision to lift the sanctions will incite violence against Palestinians. Fawaz Gerges, professor of Middle Eastern politics and international relations at the London School of Economics, joins us now. Fawaz, how do you assess the implications of Trump's recent policy reversal on Israeli settlers?
Well, first of all, we are not surprised. Donald Trump has assembled a national security team that fully supports the settlers in the occupied and the Palestinian occupied West Bank, and also supports the far right hardliners in the Benjamin Netanyahu coalition. In fact, the challenge, the overarching aim of the settlers in Israel and their Trump supporters is to annex the occupied West Bank in the next 1 or 2 years. So far from supporting a Palestinian state, the national security team that President Trump assembled basically may and could provide the pretext to help the settlers annex the entire West Bank and not just to build new settlements on occupied Palestinian territories. So this is it could be a fundamental transformative change if and when the Trump administration agrees to the annexation of the occupied West Bank.
I'm curious, just to be clear, are you suggesting that the Trump administration is consciously trying to do that?
Oh, absolutely. This is an open secret. This is not my words. In fact, the debate on the annexation of the West Bank has been taking place for almost a year. Some of Donald Trump's major financial donors in the United States, I'm talking about tens of millions of dollars, have made it very clear that they would like him to accept the potential annexation of the West Bank in the same way that he agreed to Israel's annexation of the occupied Syrian occupied Golan Heights. I don't know if you remember, right, and viewers remember. So people are talking about, will Donald Trump support the establishment of an independent and viable Palestinian state? I, in fact, turn the question upside down. Will there be any West Bank to really recognize as part of a Palestinian state if and when the settlers and their supporters in the United States basically converge, coalesce in order to really annex the West Bank? I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I'm saying it's on the table. It's being discussed. There's a debate raging.
How might Trump's reversal on sanctions impact the Israel-Hamas ceasefire, which is in a delicate place right now?
Well, I don't think it will have major implications. I think the big question about the ceasefire, will the ceasefire or is the ceasefire a temporary one? Will Benjamin Netanyahu and Hamas go through the second and third phase? Benjamin Netanyahu has made it very clear that it's not the end of the war. This is a temporary ceasefire. He would like to get the hostages who are still alive back and then resume the war against Hamas. The question is, will Donald Trump accept Benjamin Netanyahu's decisions or potential decision to resume the war in Gaza? My take on it is that Donald Trump played a major role in bringing about the ceasefire by exerting pressure on Netanyahu. And this tells you about the contradictions of Donald Trump's statement and positions and vision. On the one hand, he basically pressured Benjamin Netanyahu to accept the ceasefire. On the other hand, he reverses the sanctions of settlers, far-right, hardline settlers who have been attacking the Palestinians and burning their crops and their homes and their properties.
Farwar Gerges, does lifting sanctions on violent settlers undermine U.S. credibility in the peace process in general?
Well, I'm sorry. I know your question is really well meant. What credibility? I can tell you as a student and as a scholar of the Middle East, the United States has no credibility, no moral authority. It has lost really all kind of credibility in the past, 15 months. But the big question is, how will America's allies, particularly Saudi Arabia and Egypt, view Trump's decision? In particular, Donald Trump's priority is to, as he said last night, he said he would like to see normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel in his second term. But Saudi Arabia has made it very clear it will not normalize relations with Israel unless Israel recognizes a Palestinian state or a clear path to the establishment of a Palestinian state. So the implication, my take on it, is that we're not going to see, more likely, we're not going to see any kind of normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel, because that's really what Donald Trump would like to see in the next year or so.
Farwar Gerges from the London School of Economics. Many thanks to you, sir.
That report and interview are from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. They're also available at most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. On to NHK Japan. An update on the Nippon lawsuit to reinstate the purchase of U.S. steel, which was blocked by Joe Biden. The South Korean impeached President Yoon continues to refuse answering questions on corruption. Most Japanese companies are set to raise their workers' pay in their annual wage negotiations. NHK Japan.
Nippon Steel's lawsuit to overturn a decision to block its purchase of U.S. steel will have its first hearing in court on February 3rd. The two companies filed the suit on January 6th after then-U.S. President Joe Biden halted the $14 billion deal, citing national security concerns. The steelmakers say the Biden ruling was politically motivated and want the courts to overrule it. Sources say the trial is likely to run through March 17th. The Japanese and U.S. companies agreed on the acquisition back in December 2023, and it was then reviewed by the Committee on Foreign Investment for approval. However, the committee failed to reach a consensus, which sent the deal to Biden, and he blocked it. The steelmakers were initially ordered to abandon the deal by February 2nd, but have been granted an extension to June 18th.
South Korea's anti-corruption agency says it's transferred its investigation of impeached President Yoon Suk-yeol to prosecutors who have the authority to indict him. The Corruption Investigation Office for high-ranking officials made the announcement Thursday. It's been working with the police to probe Yoon. Yoon faces charges of colluding with then-Defense Minister Kim Yong-hyun and military commanders to start a riot by declaring martial law on December 3rd for the purpose of insurrection. The investigation team arrested Yoon on Sunday due to concerns he may destroy evidence, but he's refused to cooperate with questioning. The prosecution is expected to continue with its investigation and decide by early February whether to indict the president.
An NHK survey released to coincide with the start of annual wage negotiations in Japan shows that over 90% of companies are ready to raise pay this year. NHK conducted the survey of 100 major companies from December 13th through January 15th. 69 firms responded to a question on whether they plan to pay their workers more. One-third of them said that they will. 59% said that they're highly likely to increase wages. More than a quarter of those companies are planning a hike of between 5 and 7%, while almost two-thirds said they haven't made any decision on the scale of increase. 2% are eyeing raises of 7% or more. Japan's biggest labour group, Rengo, plans to demand increases of at least 5% in this year's wage negotiations, which kicked off on Wednesday. Companies that are considering bigger raises than they awarded last year were asked about their reasons, with multiple answers allowed. Almost 80% said they want to secure workers, and about 70% cited the higher cost of living.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan. On shortwave, they're heard at 9 p.m. at 11735 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp, as well as most podcast sites. All the times they announce are for Pacific time, so please adjust them to your time zone. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or can help support this program, there's a link for online donations available at my website, outfarpress.com, or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who's ever helped keep this freely distributed show airborne. And if you're listening on a public radio station, there's soon going to be an even greater need for your support there as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. Biden gave clemency to Leonard Peltier, who had spent 46 years in prison. Mexicans gathered outside the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City to protest the new anti-immigrant policies. Radio Havana, Cuba.
In one of his last official acts before leaving the White House, President Joe Biden released Leonard Peltier from prison. The action is an extraordinary move that ends a decades-long push by indigenous activists, international religious leaders, human rights organizations, and Hollywood insiders who argued that the 80-year-old Native American activist was wrongly convicted. The commutation was widely opposed by law enforcement, who insisted that Peltier's actions were cold-blooded and he should remain imprisoned for the rest of his life for murdering FBI agents Jed Kohler and Ronald Williams in 1975. The agents' deaths came at a time when tensions were high over a nationwide struggle between the U.S. government and activists for Native American civil and treaty rights. Biden's action isn't a pardon that forgives Peltier's offense, but rather a commutation, which lessens his sentence and effectively frees him from prison. Peltier suffers from complications related to diabetes, kidney disease, and near blindness, and his attorneys argue that he would not survive much longer in prison. Peltier has been held in Florida at Coleman 1, a federal detention center in Sumter County. Peltier's latest bid for parole was denied last July. He wasn't eligible for another hearing until June 2026.
Mexicans have gathered outside the U.S. Embassy in the capital, Mexico City, to protest against the newly inaugurated president, Donald Trump, over his anti-immigrant policies. The protesters blasted seriously sweeping executive orders announced by Trump in the first day of his second term as president, including those making sweeping changes to immigration and border security, and the first steps in enacting a far-reaching agenda to expand America's territory. The protesters also dismissed an order signed by Trump to change the name of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America. They beat up a piñata alluding to Trump with a wooden stick before burning it. Trump was running on Monday to become the first felon to occupy the White House. He had vowed to move swiftly and aggressively on reshaping federal immigration policy once he's sworn in, vowing to launch mass deportations and undo his predecessor Joe Biden administration's policies.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 5 p.m. to 11 at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you could stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday Pacific time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You do have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows. Find information for online support. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 28th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. While I'm still recuperating from a spinal injury, I'm staying in a house that's connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.